So in part one, I described the decline of feudalism after 1381, both in England and elsewhere in Europe. In this video, I want to give more of a sense of the rise of capitalism in the 1500s. That's right, I'm talking about the 1500s, not the 19th century or the 18th century or the Industrial Revolution. This is much earlier than you might imagine for the so-called rise of capitalism. Now, this is quite a complex area, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to get somewhat in the weeds later on in this video. But just to start off with, I thought I'd touch on some basics. And again, some people will call me myopic, but I'm going to focus on England and London yet again. But there is a very good reason for this, because capitalism as we know it today, modern capitalism, does originate on these shores. And during the course of this video, I hope to show exactly why I think that. So let's start with some of the very basics here. We tend to think of the plague as being something from the medieval period, but in fact, it still carried on raging into the Renaissance and beyond. These are the deaths from plague in London. You can see there, 1563, 20,000 people died. 1593, 15,000 people died. 1603, 36,000 people died in London alone of plague. That was a sixth of the total population at that time. The average age expectancy was just 30. The infant mortality rate was 50%. So you know, you wouldn't, 50% of people would not get to their 15th birthday. Well, there was, of course, no hospitals or medical care at this time. You'd be lucky if the proverbial, you know, the physician turns up with his leech. So, you know, even though we think of the Renaissance as being this great uplift, life was still pretty grim on the ground. However, despite this, the population of England was booming during this time. It was rapidly rising. You can see there in 1564, 3 million people. By 1600, it was 4 million. By 1616, it was 4.5 million. So that's 500,000 people increase in just 16 years. The birth rate was 40 per 1,000 as compared with 13 per 1,000 today. The population of London in 1520 was just 60,000. By 1550 it doubled. By 1600 it almost doubled again. And by 1650 there were 375,000 people living in London, making it the fastest growing city in Europe. 10,000 people moved to London from elsewhere in England every single year. And why? Well, wages were around 50% higher. It's estimated that about an eighth of people in England lived in London at one time or another during this period. And you can see what I was talking about, urbanisation. There it is. 10,000 people every single year at a time when the population of England was about 4 million. So that's quite a lot of people moving to London every year. Who were these people? They would have been the villeins and the peasants of old. But now they were moving to London to ply their trade as merchants, as artisans, as people who make things, as actors, as all sorts of people who just 100 years earlier probably would have just been peasants working on a field, were now going to be urban labourers in London. And honestly, it makes me excited to see this march towards modernity. So what counts for all of this growth? It is, of course, commerce. Exports, first of all. The English economy depended very strongly on the textiles industry. Three quarters of all of England's exports during this period came from trading woolen cloth, and the remainder were mainly other textiles and also some lead tin, grains, coals, skins, and they were sending this stuff to places like Russia, Morocco, Tuscany, and Malta. By 1600, London handled more than 85% of all of England's exports, and that was more than 100,000 woolen cloths passing through per year at a value of £750,000, which, if you adjust for inflation, trust me, is a very big number. So what was coming in the other way while all these exports were going out? Well, there were imports. Sack, which is this kind of light wine, came in from Spain from the merchant venturers of Bristol. You had furs, oils and wax coming in from Russia. That's the Muscovy Company. You had silks and spices from Turkey in the Middle East. That's the Levant Company. Peppers, cloves, nutmeg and other spices from the East India Company. Indigo, cotton, textiles, sugar, saltpeter coming in from the East India Company, and sugar, fish, hide, tobacco, silver, and so on from the Americas. And they were coming in on the boats of the privateers. And if you don't know, privateers were essentially legalized pirates. So there's a Francis Drake, who's rather famous privateer, and you can see there Elizabeth the First kind of anointing his mission, but effectively what Drake would do is he'd sail around with his, he wouldn't have an English flag up there, he'd essentially be without a flag or with a black flag, a pirate, and he would intercept those Spanish galleons which were coming back from places like Peru, you know, hulking with gold that they'd stolen from the Native Americans or the Native Peruvians, however you want to say it, the Red Indians basically, and he would hook on to the side of those ships and take all of that loot back to England. And this was actually, it's about 10% of the English economy at one time was based solely on privateering, basically theft. So anyway, you can see by the 15th century the flow of trade here was pretty significant. You can see all sorts of commercial activity blossoming during this time. There's the spice route, which had effectively replaced the Silk Road. Great to see. And, of course, a little bit later on, you get the spread of colonialism and all of that stuff. By the 17th century, you can see, truly, they were living in an increasingly globalizing world. And just to contrast what all of this was doing to that old feudal order I was telling you about last time, you can contrast the source of wealth of the old aristocracy, which was of course the rents and the taxes they got through the ownership of their land, with these kind of early capitalists that I'm calling the merchants, the manufacturers, you know, the people making the textiles, these urban professionals who were moving to London, and their chief source of wealth was profits from trade and commercial activity brought about by their own efforts. So on the one hand you have birthright, and on the other hand you have what is effectively a meritocracy. And of course the capitalists, or this new bourgeois class, were a great threat to the old aristocracy. And in England this all came to a head in the mid-1600s, when of course we had the Civil War and Oliver Cromwell. But what I want to do in this video is show how the wheels of capitalism were turning well before this point. In fact, we can date it right back to the start of the 1500s, around the time of the Reformation. At the same time as the Reformation was carving a deep and divisive rift through Europe, there was a great flourishing of commercial and industrial activity that we recognise today as being capitalism in its nascent state, and with it, seemingly, a new attitude towards work, money and profits. Why did this happen shortly after the Reformation? Could it be that something in the mindset and moral character of people changed because of a change in their religious belief? It was this question that ultimately animated Max Weber's famous essay, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, written in 1905, which was translated in 1930 by the renowned American sociologist Talcott Parsons. In it, Weber argued that, by way of Calvin's doctrine of callings, the Protestant work ethic lies at the heart of modern-day capitalism, and it was ultimately this that propelled the Industrial Revolution of the 1800s. This view found support in Ernst Troeltsch's Protestantism and Progress, 1912. A few years after the English translation of Weber's essay, Robert K. Merton, a student of Parsons, published Science, Technology and Society in 17th Century England in 1938, in which he outlined an argument, later known as the Merton thesis, that effectively extended Weber's argument to correlate Protestantism, not only with capitalism, but also with the rise of science. Christopher Hill expanded the thesis further in Intellectual Origins of the English Revolution, 1965, which was put to much scrutiny by Hugh Trevor Roper in a lengthy review, and then later a long essay, The Religious Origins of the Enlightenment, 1967. Trevor Roper sought to challenge Hill's view that the Puritans were the moderns and the Catholics and later the English Cavaliers, the ancients.
Good evening and welcome to History Today. Tonight's topic, a most exciting topic if I may say, is the Enclosures Act and its effect on English rural population. Professor Lewis, I wonder if you would agree that the most perceptive analysis of 14th century culture may be garnered from the literature of the time, Langland, Bunyan, and specifically Chaucer.
Gat hente and sorwe hem the lande went into the quente broche awa the pande. O kinge, I would thou knelte dignule in date, ne scrivenish or craftile the witterite.
Indeed. And how exactly would you interpret this piece?
That's how your mum talks. She's got a bit missing from her mouth. It's a tragedy.
I see. See one of those boxes with a drawing of a cow on it, and when you turn it upside down, it goes moo.
Moo?
Yes, moo.
I have observed the novelty item.
That's your stereo, that. That's your state-of-the-art Hitachi.
More recently, Weber's thesis was revived by David S. Lands in his magisterially sweeping The Wealth and Poverty of Nations, 1998. Weber's thesis, often misread to be more reductive than it is, would find many opponents, far too many to list in this video. I will note just six key objectors. The first is Werner Stombart, who argued in The Jews and Modern Capitalism that capitalism developed mainly because of the Jews being excluded from medieval guilds and pushed into usury. R.H. Tawney is the second one, who's still towering Religion and the Rise of Capitalism, 1926, argued that Weber's thesis is too linear and simplistic, and that the practical consequences of the Reformation resulted in a moral travesty in which religion now justified trade, commercialism, and ultimately self-interest, greed, and profit. It won't surprise you to learn that Tawney was a socialist. Third, H.M. Robertson, who in Aspects of the Rise of Economic Individualism, 1933, insisted that the causes of capitalism were secular rather than religious, and in any case, they predate the Reformation. Fourth, the aforementioned Hugh Trevor Roper, who in a long essay, Religion, the Reformation and Social Change, locates the spirit of capitalism not in Lutheranism or Calvinism, but in the work of Erasmus. He argues that the developments of the Reformation are a natural extension of Renaissance humanist thinking and are not necessarily Protestant in character. Fifth, there's Fernand Braudel, who in his masterpiece, Civilization and Capitalism, argued along materialist lines that there are more things in the world than the Protestant ethic, and that Northern Europe overtook the Mediterranean after 1590 because of its lower wages, its increasingly unbeatable industry, its cheap transport, its fleet of coasters. So Braudel says this was a matter of pounds, shillings and pence of competitive costs. Incidentally, this view is wildly held by economists today. And sixth, finally, there is G.R. Elton, who, in his characteristically positivist approach to history, objected strongly to Weber's theoretical approach, as well as to Tawney's and to Hill's. And he argued that the Weber thesis was effectively a faith in despite of the facts. And what are the facts? Simply that the Protestant leaders were almost always moralistic and explicitly preached charity against profiteering and worldly success. Elton says, it was not Calvinism that freed man from the restraints of the traditional moral concepts in economics, but emancipation from religion and theology in general, which enabled men, pursuing the logic of palpable economic fact, either to ignore the thunders of the clergy, or ultimately to persuade some clergy to come to terms. So, for our purposes in this video, the evidence shows that two things are beyond doubt. First is that capitalism, or at least rampantly self-interested commercial activity, predates Protestantism, even as Weber himself says that it is as old as the history of man. However, before the late 1500s, it was allowed only sporadic manifestations. That is, it wasn't allowed to flourish. Second, that despite all this disagreement, there is wide consensus that something in the moral temper of Europe and England specifically changed during the 1500s. In passing, I will add that to my mind the true spirit of capitalist thinking must have an entrepreneurial element as well as a work ethic, and I do not think that Calvin provides much in the way of capitalist enterprise. We can find it instead in Niccolo Machiavelli, whose instrumental opportunism, not to mention his emphasis on the self-interested nature of human beings and their capacity for free will and agency in the face of contingency, seems to me entirely in keeping with individualist capitalist enterprise. The march towards modern business ethics is much more obviously found in Englishmen influenced by Machiavelli, Thomas Cromwell, William Camden, Walter Raleigh, Francis Bacon, and possibly even William Shakespeare, than it is in those influenced by Calvin, even if Machiavelli tended to emphasize civic greatness and social order over profit-making. I do not think that it is too crude to suggest that a Machiavellian would make a fantastic entrepreneur, a calculated risk-taker and pragmatist who acts for self-gain, whereas a Calvinist would make an excellent factory worker, a dutiful employee, whose anxiety about salvation ensures maximum productivity. Of course, both are necessary for capitalism to keep ticking along. One thing that Weber surely did get correct was that there was a general reorientation of the self in this period towards what he calls practical rationalism, we may also observe the parallel development of individualistic civic English nationalism. In this period, we see the rise of the joint stock companies, including the Merchant Adventurers of England, the Muscovy Company, the Levant Company, and of course, a name that would become synonymous with capitalism later on, the East India Company. And with this development, we see both a renewed justification of the profit motive and an emphasis on individual enterprise. Before 1601, the only book published in English which advertised business in its title overtly was in fact William Shakespeare's own Merchant of Venice. By the end of that decade, books about business had become a burgeoning industry. Their contents are revealing. Let's consider these statements from Giovanni Bottero, notably an Italian Jesuit and a Thomist who believed in natural law and strongly opposed Protestantism. His treatise concerning the magnificence and greatness of city was translated into English in 1606 by Robert Peterson. And here's what he has to say. This prophet is of such power to unite and tie men fast into one place, as the other causes aforesaid, without this accompany them withal, are not sufficient to make any city great. Profit is the very thing from whence, as from this principal cause, the greatness of the city's growth. There is not a thing of more importance to increase a state and to make it both populous of inhabitants and rich of all good things than the industry of men and the multitude of the arts. So you can see here how Bottero stresses the positive effects of commercial growth. He sees profit as a force that can bring people together under a common goal, bound in industry, even if they're competitors. And on this score, of course, he was absolutely right. Bottero suggests that growth in one industry will lead to growth in other industries, which will make a city rich of all good things. It is interesting that he mentions the arts here, which is almost certainly meant in the sense of learning or education. Bottero is making an unmistakably bourgeois link here between commercial prosperity and education. In a treatise of commerce in 1601, John Wheeler, the secretary of the Merchant Adventurers Guilds of England, echoes this line of thinking. He says, "To conclude, all that a man worketh with his hands, or discourseth with his spirit, is nothing else but merchandise, and a trial to be put in practice the contracts, the which words in effect comprehend in them all negotiations, and are none other than mere matter of merchandise and commerce. Now, albeit this affection be in all persons generally both high and low, yet there are of the notablest and principalest traffickers which are ashamed, and think scorn to be called merchants, whereas indeed merchandise, which is used of proper vacation, is not to be despised or accounted base by men of judgment, but to the contrary, by many reasons and examples it is to be proved that the estate is honourable." Now, back in the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas had placed merchants right at the bottom of the hierarchy of professions. They were below farmers, artisans, and even peasants. In the Middle Ages, profit-seeking was tantamount to avarice, a damnable sin. Economic interests were secondary to seeking salvation for one's soul, and understood as being antagonistic to that goal. Business transactions in that age were by necessity, for the simple trade of goods and services, and not for any ends beyond that. Thus, there was a long-lasting stigma in Christian moral thought on commercial matters, especially on the question of usury and the charging of interest rates. And this persisted in the Elizabethan era, for example, in Thomas Wilson's A Discourse of Usury, published in 1572. So it is unsurprising to find Wheeler somewhat embattled in his defence of merchants and the profit motive here, but rather telling that he feels so emboldened to make this argument in the first place. I mean, clearly, even by 1601, the atmosphere had changed from 1572. And to all of this, Sir Walter Raleigh adds a note of nationalistic competitiveness. He says, "Not so ever a dearth of wine or corn here, or other merchandise, but forthwith the embedeners, Hamburgers and Hollanders, out of their storehouses laid 50, 100 or more ships, dispersing them round about this kingdom, and carry away great store of coin and wealth for little commodities, in those times of dearth, which by means they suck our commonwealth of our riches, cut down our merchants, and decay our navigation, not with their natural commodities, which groweth in their own country, but with the merchandises of other countries and kingdoms. Therefore it is far more easy for us to serve ourselves, hold up our merchants, increase our ships and mariners, strengthen the kingdom, and not only keep our money in our own realm, which other nations still rob us of, but bring in there who carry ours away, and make the bank of coin and storehouse to serve other nations as well and far better cheap than they in England." So where Bottereau still thought on the level of the city, you can see that Raleigh is thinking here on the level of the nation-state. Raleigh is palpably angry about foreign traders making profits at England's expense. What is interesting, however, is that apparently his anger stems from the fact that England already has enough goods. It appears that because foreign merchandise is flooding the market, supply is outstripping demand, and this is hurting local merchants both by direct competition and by keeping the price of their wares low. In a plan that would not be alien to Donald Trump, Raleigh's solution is to fight the foreigners at their own game, increase English exports while adopting a form of protectionism at home. And we can see in Raleigh's line of thought the burgeoning mercantilism which dominated European economic theory until Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations in 1776. The radical implications of the ideas outlined by Bottereau, Wheeler, and Raleigh cannot be overestimated, and in them we can see the eventual and inevitable overthrow of the nobility by the bourgeoisie. Between them, they make at least three crucial theoretical moves. Number one, they say that human industry and commerce are inextricably linked, and this is natural. Two, that profits and capital growth create a net benefit for society, and this is good. And three, that nation-states must therefore virulently protect their own interests, that is, ensuring capital growth by outmaneuvering other nations because their gain is your loss. And today we can recognize in this line of thinking both utilitarianism and Machiavellian consequentialism, working backwards from the perceived positive ends of commerce to the means. So here we can see, at the start of the 1600s, well before the Industrial Revolution, well before Napoleon, well before even Adam Smith, capitalism is already in full swing. And you can't really say that the economy and trade are in the hands of lords or the aristocracy. You know, these joint stock company holders, these weren't necessarily lords and nobles. They were people making their own way. They were, as Marx would say, the bourgeoisie. Now, someone asked me in the comments of part one, what about the Hansa? What about the rise of the Hanseatic League in Germany and in places like Bruges would have been a famous example. And yes, they did have, I guess, a flourishing of commercial activity in those places, but commerce was basically locked down by the guilds, who were effectively what we would call today cartel groups. You know, they had monopolies on each of the commodities they were selling, so there was no true competition. If you were part of the blacksmith's guild, the blacksmith essentially had a price fix on the, you know, the iron or metal goods that they were working. So I can't really say that modern capitalism was flourishing. Even though those guys were making a lot of money, it was under monopoly conditions. What I hope to show was that there was true competition at this time, not only competition between the different adventurer companies, those joint stock companies I was showing you, but also the competition that Raleigh was worrying about between the different nations. You can see that, you know, that spirit of competition driving people forward, which was closed down by those kind of guilds in the late Middle Ages there. Not to say that they weren't making money, they were, but it's not quite that, what I would call modern capitalism or free market conditions. And I think the same person asked me about the Italian city-states, and I did quote quite heavily from Bottero in this video, who is, of course, from one of those city-states. And yes, they did have something that I would consider a precursor, at least, to modern free market capitalism. And if anything, when the likes of Raleigh and other people minded like him get their hands on it, they turn it into mercantilism, which is this kind of dog-eat-dog, zero-sum game way of thinking about trade, especially trade between nations. And so almost immediately you get a rise of protectionism and that's what mercantilism is. It's a shutting down of free markets between nations, which is effectively what happens in the 17th and the 18th century until David Ricardo comes up with his free trade principles. So you do have this period where there are free markets within countries but not between countries. That's the big difference between mercantilism and true laissez-faire free market capitalism, which they had in the mid-19th century. So that's where I'm going to leave this. There is, of course, a lot more to tell about the development of capitalism. After this point, you get the inevitable march towards the Industrial Revolution. All I wanted to do in this pair of videos was to show how the rise of capitalism happens a lot earlier than many Marxists would chart it. You know, the idea that it just starts with Napoleon, or the idea that it starts at some point in the 19th century, is just absurd if you know anything about history. And to be fair, not all Marxists would make that claim. It's just I was reacting to people who were acting that way on Twitter and elsewhere. I hope you got something from this. Let me know in the comments. I'm sure if I made any mistakes, you'll also let me know. And see you around.